Welcome to the Best Interest Podcast, where we believe Benjamin Franklin's advice that an investment in knowledge pays the best interest, both in finances and in your life. Every episode teaches you personal finance and investing in simple terms. Now, here's your host, Jesse Kramer.
Hello and welcome to episode 79 of the Best Interest Podcast. My name is Jesse Kramer. I'm excited and honored that Phil Perlman will be joining me later today. Phil, despite spending most of his career working in finance-related fields, now dedicates his life to health-related topics, personal health. But this isn't a personal health podcast, it's a personal finance podcast. But I think we'll convince you today to start thinking about health as one of the ultimate personal finance topics. But first, let's do our customary listener review. This one comes from Apple Podcasts. I love reading your reviews and seeing your ratings on Apple Podcasts or five-star ratings on Spotify. So thank you all for leaving those. This review comes from Frankie Ravs. Frankie wrote, "Jesse's five-star podcast is appropriate for the nascent investor or the hardened dollar-cost averaging acolyte. Come for the practical wisdom, remain for the dulcet tones, and convert dollars into long-term soldiers. Like the Heaven's Gate cult, you'll soon be drinking the 401k Kool-Aid and accelerating your net worth faster than the Hale-Bopp Comet. I'll hang up and listen." Well, Frankie, that was quite the unique review. Thank you very much. I will certainly remember this one, and I'm sure potential listeners who come see the podcast and see that review, they'll probably tune in and listen. At the very least, they'll say, wow, Frankie has a unique take on things. So Frankie, thank you so much. Shoot me an email, jesse@bestinterest.blog. And we'll get you hooked up with a Best Interest t-shirt. Now, before we get to Phil today, I want to talk about some interesting connections between money and time and health. You know, we know money and time share an intrinsic connection that really permeates every aspect of our lives, from the most mundane daily decisions to the grandest of ambitions. And at its core, that relationship is rooted in a few fundamental concepts, one of which is opportunity cost, which is the notion that the value of one choice can be measured by what we forego by not making a different choice. Now, time, as the proverbial currency of life, it's finite, it's replaceable, and each passing moment represents an opportunity to allocate our time towards various activities, whether it's pursuing our passions or building a relationship, perhaps engaging in work. And the decisions that we make regarding how we spend our time are intimately tied to our personal values, our goals, our priorities. Now, money, on the other hand, it's a tangible representation of value that enables us to access goods or services or to experience some sort of fun experiences. Money serves as a medium of exchange, allowing us to trade our time and our skills for compensation, which we'll come back to that idea. Money acts in some way as a trade-off for time. We can convert time into money, and we can convert money into time. And money also allows us to acquire the resources necessary to fulfill our needs and our desires in life. However, unlike time, money is renewable. It can be earned and saved, invested and spent. Now, the connection between money and time becomes particularly evident when we consider the concept of earning power. In a modern economy like ours, the value of an individual's time is often quantified by their earning potential. The wages or salaries we receive from our labor, those reflect not only the skills and the expertise we bring to the table, but also the time we invest in our work. Now, that idea right there, that's a pillar of the financial independence movement, right? The value of our time can be quantified in some way by our earning potential, our future earning potential, or spending needs in retirement. Now, conversely, the decisions we make about how to allocate our money can have significant implications on how we use our time. Wealth provides the opportunity to delegate tasks, to outsource responsibilities, streamline processes, and that frees up time for other pursuits. So there's an instance where we take money and we convert it back into time, right? When we're working, we take time, we convert it into money. And once we have enough wealth, we can take our money and convert it back into time. Very interesting. It goes in both directions. Now, financial constraints, on the other hand, may compel us to devote more time to activities like household chores or DIY projects or long commutes that could otherwise be outsourced or streamlined with sufficient resources. Now, the relationship between money and time, it extends beyond the realm of individual decision-making to influence actually broader societal structures and dynamics. Economic disparities, for example, can exacerbate inequalities in access to time-saving resources and opportunities. People with greater financial means They may enjoy access to conveniences like domestic help or childcare services or private transportation, allowing them to reclaim their own precious time for their own leisure or personal development or meaningful pursuits in ways that other people in society can't really do. And it's all a trade-off of time and money. Now, ultimately, the connection between money and time, it really underscores the importance of mindful decision-making in both realms. By recognizing the value of our time and our resources, we can strive to align our actions with our priorities, to maximize our own well-being, and ideally, to cultivate a more fulfilling life. Whether through budgeting or investing in experiences or pursuing financial independence, understanding the intrinsic relationship between money and time, it empowers us to make informed decisions, informed choices that honor both our present and our future selves. Well, better health decisions can also profoundly impact the quality and the quantity of our time in the rest of our lives. When we prioritize our health and our well-being, we invest in our future. We enhance our resilience and our longevity. Things like increased lifespan, right? Healthy lifestyle choices, whether it's maintaining a balanced diet or exercise or getting enough sleep or managing stress, those are all associated with longer life expectancy. And they help reduce the risk of chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, certain types of cancer, increasing our likelihood of enjoying more years of life. Focusing on health gets us more time. And we just talked about how time and money really are interchangeable. So in some sort of weird mathematical way, maybe with equal signs, I'm not exactly sure what the equation would look like, but essentially money equals time, but health also equals time. So there's some sort of, the transitive property, the commutative property. If A equals B and B equals C, therefore A equals C. I forget what my elementary math is, but if time equals money and health equals money, well, and then some way right there, there's a connection between all three of those. Or by focusing on health, you can increase your health span, as Peter Attia would call it. Health span, you can think of that as enhanced quality of life. Good health isn't just about living longer, it's also about living better. By adopting habits that support our physical or our mental or emotional health, we just have a simply higher quality of life. It means experiencing fewer limitations due to illness or disability, and being able to engage fully in the activities and relationships that bring us joy and fulfillment. There's another time connection here, which could just be improved productivity. Optimal health is closely linked with cognitive function and productivity. When we prioritize activities that give us better mental clarity, we'll call it, whether that's exercise or adequate sleep or stress management, we can improve and enhance our focus and creativity and efficiency. It translates into accomplishing more in less time, essentially buying us more time, whether that's in a professional or a personal setting. And I also think about enhanced relationships. Good health fosters stronger connections with others by enabling us to show up fully into our relationships. And when we feel physically and emotionally well, we're more capable of offering support and empathy and companionship to our loved ones. We can invest our own time in nurturing those relationships. And that provides a sense of fulfillment and belonging that enriches our lives in a way that's really hard to measure. And that harkens back to the famous Harvard Grant study, the longitudinal study that followed many Boston citizens throughout their entire life, actually. And the way that the study summary was written, it starts out quite simply. It says, happiness in life can be boiled down to one thing, love. Not like a romance story love. We're not talking about like the movie Love Actually. Really, what we're talking about there is relationships. That all happiness, all happy people share something in common, and that is relationships. So good health, fostering stronger connections, fostering those enhanced relationships leads to a better, happier, longer life. By making better health decisions, it's not just about adding years to our lives. It's about adding life to our years. Prioritizing our health and our well-being can create conditions for a more vibrant, fulfilling existence where time is not just a measure of quantity, but also a precious resource to be savored and enjoyed to the fullest. So as we segue right now into the conversation with Phil Perlman, I want to keep that idea in mind that in some sort of nuanced way or some sort of soft way, if you prefer to be kind of more of the creative side of the brain, or maybe in an actual hard nuts and bolts mathy way, if you're more on the math side of the brain, health and wealth and time are all interchangeable in some way, shape, or form. So as Phil and I dive into what ends up being mostly a health-related conversation today, sure, it's about health, it's about diet, it's about exercise, it's about stress, it's about addiction, it's about all those kind of topics. But at its core, it's also about time. And therefore, it's also in some way about money. It's about personal finances in that way. So I hope you'll keep that in mind as we start talking with Phil Perlman.
Here's a quick ad, and then we'll get back to the show. Every week, I send a quick free email to thousands of readers that shares three simple things. One, my new articles and podcasts. Two, the best financial content of the week from all over the internet. And three, a financial chart that explains some important concept in the news that week. It's a great primer to boost your financial know-how.
But Jesse, I don't want another email.
Well, this might not be for you, but I do hear you, which is why I make it very short, sweet, and full of only the essentials. A whopping 66% of subscribers read my email at least once a month. They're enjoying it, and maybe you will too. You can subscribe for free on the homepage at bestinterest.blog. Again, that's a free, no-strings-attached subscription at bestinterest.blog.
I met Phil Perlman back in December when I had a few conversations with him back and forth because Phil is highly respected in the finance space. I know a lot of other, for example, financial content creators who have significantly, you know, bigger audiences than the Best Interest. They're doing some great work and they would talk about Phil. And I was like, oh, I wonder who this guy Phil is. I knew he had a background in finance. I knew that he was involved in psychology in some way, which is very interesting. Behavioral finance, why people make the decisions that they make. And he had a career on Wall Street. But everything that I saw with people talking about Phil had to do with health. And so I started following Phil. I was interested in what he was doing. I was interested in his writing. I really like Phil's writing, some of which we share in the show notes below. And ultimately, I reached out to Phil in December because Phil, for the first time in his kind of new career, which is health related, was offering a 10-week educational course. And I'm the kind of person where I've been an athlete all my life, but I've always struggled, I'd say, on the dietary side my whole life, where I've never really thought too much about what to eat or why I should be eating it. And thus, especially with some of my recent career change and just the frequent access to going out for breakfast, going out for lunch, going out for a drink, that kind of thing, I've put on some pounds in the recent couple of years. And I don't want to do it for my own self, you know, selfishly. I'd rather feel better and look better and then just be healthier, but also for the sake of my family. You know, I've got a kid coming in June and I want to be healthy for my child. And it's just health is equated to time, is equated to money. It makes sense to get healthy. So I reached out to Phil and for 10 weeks, Phil provided some education and we had one-on-one calls and I learned a lot from Phil and I really enjoy his approach, which is in some ways simple, in many ways motivational. And I think that comes across today. And I wanted to get Phil on the podcast to share his message with you all. So without further ado, here is Phil Perlman. Phil, thanks for joining us today. Very excited to talk to you about health and how it pertains to wealth. And maybe I don't want to spend too much time diving into the nitty-gritty of your background, but the audience might appreciate understanding you do have a little bit of a finance background from an interesting psychiatry route that eventually got to where you are now. And without spending 10 minutes on it, but do you mind just spending 60 seconds real quick on how you got here?
Jesse Kramer, great to see you. Great to be here. Thank you for having me. Yeah, so I've been involved in finance for a long time. I ran a hedge fund way back in the day. I went into finance, social media. I'm an investor in a bunch of those companies and was an early investor in StockTwits and involved with finance media for a long time. I was in banking. I was a marketing director at a large bank, large regional. And I have been involved with behavioral economics for a long time. So I cut my teeth there. It was a behavioral hedge fund, but I'm a psychologist by education. So I studied behavioral economics from the other way. I studied the psychology first, the psychology of decision-making. I mean, I knew who Kahneman and Tversky were years before they won the, you know, years before Kahneman won the Nobel Prize and he got famous from decision-making, social psych. He was a social psychologist. He was a decision theorist. And there's a whole vein of social psychology that is choice and decision-making, which he helped to invent, obviously. I went through my own rebirth and was always interested in my health and well-being, but I didn't take such good care of myself. Over the last 3 years, transition, just got out of finance completely. I still have some investments there, still involved with it, doing some. I'm an advisor here for a couple of companies, but I really day-to-day am not active in finance at all anymore. And I started a company called Pearl Institute, which is focused on helping people get healthy. And the funny thing is, half of my clientele is in the advisor space. So there's a natural relationship there. My network is advisors. I know a lot of them. I work with a lot of them. And so I have a lot of clients and I understand what they're going through. And I understand their perceptions of time perspective. And that's actually a really important one in the work that I do and with advisors in general.
On the topic of decision-making, Phil, I mean, there's so much overlap between personal finance, finance, investing, and these health topics.
Right.
And I think at its core, health, longevity, health span, these truly are personal finance topics because retiring at 50 isn't great if you're dead at 60. So let's dive into some of these parallels between good financial decision-making, good health decision-making. Maybe even we can bring back some of Kahneman, Tversky, RIP, Danny Kahneman died last week. But what are some things that come to mind when you're working with people on moving them towards health goals that you think have direct parallels to what listeners will understand from the personal finance goal setting point of view?
Well, that's my whole thing, is that health and wealth, how we take care of ourselves, how we take care of our bodies and minds and spirits, and how we take care of our pocketbook are really the same thing. They're not even parallel. They're even more than they are parallel. We're going to look at the parallels, but they're really at the core. They're more than parallel. They're part of the same thing. This is a holistic enterprise, the integration of health and wealth, personal health and wealth planning, because they're really the same thing. And when I say that, what I mean is our future selves, our future well-being, and our present well-being, both are both equally dependent upon the two in a complementary manner. So if we're looking at our what our life is going to be like 25 years from now, and we think to ourselves, well, am I going to be in good health? Am I going to be fit? Am I going to be able to do things that I enjoy? That might be a mind and body thing. But then if we say, well, am I going to have the financial resources to do those things? Then it becomes a financial. So those two things go together like peanut butter and chocolate, or, you know, whatever, bread and butter, pun intended, right? Don't eat bread. It's not good. It's not healthy. So that's really how I see it. And we can look at the parallels. So there's so many parallels. One would be planning, time wisdom, and planning our today and our future, and then having a balance between the two. Because we want to have fun, you know, we want to spend money today, but we want to save money for the future. And there is a balance there. And we want to have fun today. We want to, you know, maybe have birthday cake when our kid turns 3. But we also want to be healthy when we are 65, 70 years old, and we want to be able to enjoy that money that we've saved. So there's the balance between the two. That's really a critical one. And then this one, maybe even more fundamental, is the fact, and you alluded to this when you alluded to, you know, maybe we even talk a little bit about behavioral economics. And that is that we have this tendency to, we have this gravity, we have this inertia or pull to make poor decisions in both areas, that we have this tendency to be averse to some outcomes, right? So Kahneman called it loss aversion. And so we will do things to try to avoid loss aversion and bring about losses or act irrationally. We do the exact same thing in health. And there's a lot of reasons for it. It's complicated, but there's some evolutionary reasons that are really, really interesting. But that's a fundamental parallel in the way we behave. We're so close, and money and our health are both so important to us. And when I say money, I mean money as a representation of access to resources. Both are so important. Our ability to access resources, our ability to go out and buy food and to have clothing and to live under a roof that has working plumbing and heat for the winter, and our ability to be able to move our bodies and feel good. And those things are fundamental to our lives, both of them. So it's no wonder that we focus on them and hold on to them and have such an emotional attachment to both. We have a tendency to distort and get anxious about and then misbehave in both domains.
I love that you said that, Phil. And I have a question for you now, which is, we're recording this on April 12th, 2024.
Yeah.
And here we both are. Well, let's talk about Phil Perlman on April 12th, 2025, 1 year from now. And let's talk about the probability that that Phil is here and the conclusions that you draw from that realistic fact that Phil Perlman is probably going to be here one day from now. Do you know what I'm alluding to?
Yeah, I totally do. And I love this. You're turning, the hunter gets captured by the game. You're turning this around. This is a question that I often ask. And this is something that I've written about. And this is imagining ourselves in the future, what we'll be doing and what we aspire to. So it's not just what do I look like in a year and what am I going to be doing in a year, but it's what do I aspire to be doing in a year? What would I love to be doing in a year? And where would I love to be? Here's what I'll tell you. I think I have this worked out pretty good. First of all, I love what I'm doing right now. So I help people get healthier. We have an epidemic in this country. We have an obesity and we have a metabolic health epidemic in this country right now. And there are many people out there who have the means to be healthy and they are not able to do it. And so I help people get healthy, not just for a diet, not just for 3 months or 6 months or, hey, you know, my daughter or my son is getting married 6 months from now. I'd like to be able to fit into the tuxedo or whatever, but for life as an identity, as a lifestyle. And then I also help people make decisions and make transitions in their lives. And I've been getting more and more into that as people come to me, as I get referrals. And that's more of a life planning type of a thing, executive planning, executive coaching type of a thing. I love doing that. I spent a ton of years in finance. And before that, I got my degree in clinical psychology. And there was that part of me that was a helper, but I didn't have the capacity to be a helper because I wasn't taking good care of myself. And you have to get your own house in order before you can help other people. It's a critical thing, right? You have to have your own house in order, you know, doctor, heal thyself and all that. And so I got to this point where now I'm able to help people. And it is just fantastic. I feel inspirational. I learn from them. I'm inspired. I see people that have changed their whole lives based in part on the work we do together. And that part of me has been reactivated. And that is an authentic part of me. In addition to that, I get to focus as a part of my life on my own fitness and my own athletic pursuits. And that is a part of me that I've rediscovered that was a huge part of who I was when I was young. It's a part of my authentic self, who I really, really am. And I get to do that. So as far as what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis, I can't think of much of a change. Like, I'm doing what I love to do right now. Do I want to run a 6:30 mile? Yes, that's part of it. I'll be honest. Like, I want to do that. Do I want to get to a place where I can do 20 pull-ups? Yes. But, you know, if I fail at those crazy pursuits for a 57-year-old, I can live with that. But what I really love to be doing, so that's part of it. And then the other part is helping people who are struggling, helping people who want more out of life, helping people who wake up one day and say, hey, you know, there's this part of me. I'm doing great over here. Maybe I have 10 million or 20 million bucks in the bank, but over on this side, I am suffering or I'm struggling or I'm not going to be here to enjoy it in 10 or 15 or 25 years if I don't start taking care of myself.
I love the thought process that you walked me through, Phil, where we said, you know what? And this applies to personal finance. It also applies to health in the perfect way, which is 1 year from now, there's a 99% probability, probably even greater, that I'm going to be sitting here a year from now. And that version of Jesse, except for that 10th of a percent probability that something bad happens, is just as real as the Jesse who's sitting here today. And the Phil 1 year from now is just as real as the Phil that's sitting here today. And for all you listeners, The version of you 1 year from now is just as real as the version of you today. Sure, except for some tiny percentage that something terrible happens. But when you sit down, if I were to sit down this morning and say, you know what, you only live once, you never know when that bus is going to come and hit me off the sidewalk, I'm going to go eat a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts. Well, that's a poor decision for many reasons, one of which is it ignores the fact that future me is very, very real, and future me does not benefit from that decision. And similarly, when someone thinks about, well, you never know, I might get hit by that bus, so even though I'm in terrible financial shape, I'm going to go take an all-inclusive trip to Bermuda. You can't just YOLO it, and you really are hurting your long-term prospects. Can you talk us through some of that perspective, Phil, about that realization of that future you is real, and we have to admit that to ourselves?
Well, you did a pretty good job of explaining it. I appreciate that. The multiverse is real, right? So my kids watch all those movies, the Spider-Verse. There were two of those Spider-Verse movies, and in the movies, there's like 50 different Spider-Mans. In the second one, they all meet at this place where there's like hundreds of them running around. And there's parallel universes. That's this fantasy. And a lot of times the great science fiction writers are commenting on the world we live in. And the funny thing is that the multiverse is real. There are multiple selves that exist. There's you talking to me right now in the present, and there's me talking to you. That's one self. That's one Jesse, and it's one Phil. And then there is, with a small discount for getting hit by a bus or getting a brain tumor tomorrow, chances are a year from today, Phil Perlman's going to wake up, going to get out of bed, going to go to the bathroom, take a pee, brush his teeth, pull on some pants, and go about his day. 99.8% chance. So that person is also real. That sun will rise. Just because it's in the future doesn't mean it's any less real, maybe 0.2% less real than the me that woke up this morning and did the exact same thing. And then there's the one 3 days from now. And then there's the one tomorrow. And then there's the one 10 days from now. And so given that all of those selves are real, and then there's the one 25 years from now, I want to be healthy then. And so all of those selves, as we imagine those, we have this tendency that the longer time goes out, and this is why I love working with advisors, because they have a great sense of time perspective. I went to a financial advisor and he said to me and my wife, so what would you like your life to look like in 20 years? And that day I created a notebook called the Beach House Notebook. And it was like, okay. And I put right on the front, I got it sitting right over there. It's the Beach House Notebook. And that is the notebook where I keep notes about what I have to do and what the financial plans are and what my life plans are to have this beach house in the future. And that is an advisor thing. So advisors have a very strong, we are preaching to the choir right now. Advisors have a very strong sense of time perspective. And so it made it a very, and that's why it maybe resonated with you. And I'm able to work with people like that. One problem that humans have is the further we go out in the future, the harder a time we have imagining ourselves. Hmm. We begin thinking of ourselves as a different person. And so what I want to do is I want to pull you away from that. And if I get you imagining your future self, whether it's that 1 year that you're talking about, or whether it's 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, if I get you imagining that future self in a very vivid manner, visualizing it deeply, looking at the details. What does my hair look like? What do I look like? What am I wearing? How do I feel? Who am I with? What am I doing that day? Where are my kids and what are they doing? If I do it very vividly, then that other personness of it that begins to fade, and the same person, hey, that's me that I'm thinking about. That's me that I'm imagining. That's me that I'm talking about. So it really, really makes the multiverse real. And it is real. It's just that we've had a hard time. We think of it as science fiction or fantasy. We don't realize that the multiverse is real.
I saw something recently, Phil, talking about all that visualization. They're even taking it a step further. And I think there was some research cited that even said that they're using AI. So they'll take a photo. Let's say you submit a photo of yourself, Phil, and then AI is obviously smart enough and helpful enough that it'll take your picture and say, let's age Phil by 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And seeing a picture of yourself in the future, even if it's not perfectly accurate, it's going to look like you plus 20 years. That is also helpful to say like, oh yeah, that is me. And that is really what I'm probably going to look like. And it helps people get in that mindset.
Perfect. And then the thing is, and this is a critical component of it, what do you do with that? So you look at that picture and you go, oh, I look old. What are you going to do with that now, right? What are you going to do with those thoughts? What are you going to do with this realization that the multiverse is real and that your future you is at 99.8% as real as the you right now? What are you going to do with that? And then you can begin crafting a vision for that person. One of the things that really inspired me doing this work, right? So I was very familiar with this work. This is called imaginal work in the psychology world. Hey, we're going to do imaginal exposure. If you're scared of a bridge, we're going to have you close your eyes and imagine that you're going near a bridge. You're going over a bridge. And then your heart starts racing if you're doing a good job imagining it. So now what I want to do is I want to flip that upside down and I want to say, I want to imagine that future self vividly, not a photo. I mean, the photo is helpful because it makes it real. I get that. And we're visual animals. But I want to imagine for myself who I aspire to be. What would I love to be doing? So when you asked me that question, what I'd love to be doing in a year, it was like, well, exactly what I'm doing now. Plus, I can run a 6:30 mile. Like, that's pretty much it. That's where I want to, you know, like that. I don't have too much else to change. But that ability to do that. You know, so if everybody listening today, or if somebody listening today, even if it's only one or three of the listeners, stops when they're done with this podcast and takes a few minutes to jot down on a piece of paper or in a Google Doc what they would love life to look like in a year or in 10 years or 20 years or on quote unquote retirement, and really be vivid about it, really take some time, or maybe wait till the weekend. Maybe they're listening to this on a Thursday and say, you know, I'm going to wake up Saturday morning, fresh mind, and I'm going to take a half hour, an hour, and I'm really going to think about where I would love to be. And I'm going to do it with a lot of vividness. I'm really going to let my mind go there and stay there for a bit. Turn off my phone. That, to me, is an exercise that is a very powerful exercise, and it will affect us as soon as we're done. Like, once we've done that exercise, no matter what we do the next day, we'll be altered by it. There'll be a shift just from that.
Here's a quick ad, and then we'll get back to the show. One of the more common questions I hear is, Jesse, what do you like and use? Books, blogs, podcasts, even banks and brokerage firms. What are your recommendations? So to answer that question, I put together a webpage. You can check it out at bestinterest.blog/recommendations. Again, that's bestinterest.blog/recommendations to check out how I'm improving my financial life. In the personal finance space, there's so many different opinions flying around. You know, here on The Best Interest, we talk about smart financial planning, very much a long-term diversified investing mindset, keeping things simple for long-term great results. But at the same time, there are blogs and podcasts out there that are preaching crypto. You know, there are blogs and podcasts. There's Dave Ramsey. I mean, so many different opinions flying about. And that's a parallel to the health industry or the personal health industry. From my point of view, there's so many different opinions flying about. You know, I don't want you to have to spend an hour talking about everything you believe in and why. But I'm just curious, how did you hone in on your particular health viewpoints? And do you mind just sharing a couple or a real quick brief description of your foundational health beliefs?
First of all, I was a scientist. So I became a psychologist and I learned a lot about science, social science. And I have good scientists need to be skeptical. And I think I have a little bit more than skepticism. I love science, but I hate scientists. And I think that they are bound by all of these biases that Kahneman and Tversky elucidated literally 50 years ago. I mean, that paper was published in 74.
In the 70s, yeah.
Heuristics and biases. So that's 50 years. They're bound by the same thing. So I think that there's a lot of BS, especially in the social science community, but in all science. Or I think there's a lot of BSers. And so I have a contempt. So I was resolute to come to my own conclusions. And so I built a model that I call the Pearl Scientific Method. It goes like this. I am the chief scientist and the sole subject, the only subject in the most important scientific experiment that I will ever be involved in. And this is a longitudinal experiment, which means it continues over time, as opposed to cross-sectional, which is just a snapshot at any one moment. It continues over time for my life. And I'm going to learn by what works for me. I'm going to try things and see what works. And then I'm going to cut out things that don't work. And I'm going to amplify things that do work. And that is just, I'm the scientist. I'm the subject. I am studying myself. And I have found that some things that were conventional wisdom were utter garbage, like the food pyramid that we learned about forever since we were kids in school. And we walk into Miss Adelberg's class in fifth grade, and she hands us this laminated food pyramid. And we see that we're just supposed to, you know, at the bottom of the pyramid is breads and muffins and rice. And that food is not the food we should be eating the most of. We're living in a world where we have obesity as an and metabolic health is an epidemic, metabolic illness. And the reason is because we eat too much of this garbage. We eat too much. When we eat carbohydrates, our body takes it in, turns it to sugar immediately. And then if we don't use it for energy, it turns it to fat and it winds up right here on our in our waistline, the bad kind of fat, and right here in our jowls. And we get heavy. And that is bad. That affects us in many ways. It affects our blood pressure. It affects us. It affects our internal organs and our functioning. It affects everything. It affects our energy level, stress tolerance, mood, everything, a lifespan, health span. And so I discovered for myself in this one area that eating a lower carbohydrate diet, I began to get lean. I lost 50 pounds. I gained a huge amount of energy. My mood got better. My ability to tolerate bad things coming at me improved. I also stopped drinking as part of it, a huge part of it, but those two things together. And so I'm a scientist. That's my model. I'm the scientist. I'm the subject. I'm going to read new texts and new ideas and different points of view with curiosity. And then I'm going to try certain things that resonate with me. And then I'm going to make decisions about whether I continue them or extinguish them based on my observation of myself, how I feel, how it works for me.
Some of what you shared with us in your class, Phil, was very helpful. I mean, some of the lessons that you learned in your own experiment, and you encouraged us to all run our own experiments as well. I mean, I guess that's another parallel here, which is, you know, I can sit here and talk about diversified, low-cost, passive investments and positive monthly cash flow. Simple advice, sometimes hard to implement for people. A lot of the stuff that you talked about too, there's no silver bullets. There's no magic formulas. There's no magic supplements. A lot of it was just simple advice applied in a smart way over a long period of time, getting to good results.
So what happens over time when you become your own scientist and your own subject is you discover who you are and you discover how you feel. And as you do that, you realize that you have a personality and that you have a style. And so that carries, and I notice that many of the most successful advisors have niches. They work with a specific type of client, whether it's an age group or whether it's former athletes or whether it's former entrepreneurs who have, you know, had a liquidity event. But the best advisors, not all, but they have these niches. And the best advisors, I think, found those niches honestly by it being a reflection of themselves in some way. So one guy that I know that works with entrepreneurs is one of the best entrepreneurs that I know. And one of the guys that I know who works with athletes and former athletes was a great college athlete in D1. And so that is a real honest way of coming to this. And I think that's a way that you develop, whether you're an advisor or whether you're pursuing your own health, whether it's personal health or personal wealth, where if you cultivate that for yourself and identify that and go through that process of discovering who you are, at that point, you really have an in terms of what type of work you're going to do with clients, because it becomes an authentic endeavor. It becomes something where you share an interest that is really your thing, so that when that person talks to you, you know exactly what they're talking about. And when you give them advice, that advice is coming from a place that is coming from inside yourself. So when I talk about, hey, here's the process I went through, not everybody's going to resonate with that. You know, I'll have a client here or there, and there's people out there where it's just like, listen, Phil, just tell me what to do. I don't want to go through a discovery process. I just want a set of rules. I've adapted to be able to work with those kind of people too, because they're actually very easy to work with, right? They're just like, okay, I'm going to tell you what to do, and you're going to do that. Thank you very much. It's great. Everybody's successful, everybody's happy. But that's not my bread and butter, because that's not who I am and what I went through.
And now, I read something that you wrote recently, Phil, where you talked about what? Guy Montag, Fahrenheit 451, being a rebel. As we record this on April 12th, I actually shared your article this morning with my newsletter. So listeners, if you're a subscriber of the Best Interest newsletter, you can go to bestinterest.blog and subscribe. It's totally free. You might have seen Phil's article this morning, but let's talk about that, Phil. Let's talk about addiction culture. Let's talk about being a rebel. What am I making you think of right now?
About the society that we're living in now. Are we living in a dystopia? I don't think we are, but I do think that we share some characteristics. And the big difference right now, you mentioned Guy Montag, and that's why I'm talking about dystopia and I'll get into it. And I really appreciate you asking me about this, because I got a lot, I've been thinking about it like crazy. I'm going to do my own video on this called, Are We Living in a Dystopia? And the answer is no, but we do share a lot of characteristics. And the big difference, the reason that we're not living in a dystopia right now, even with all the things that are sort of wrong, is because we're not forced. For those who don't know, dystopia is sort of this nightmarish world, right? So like 1984, where there's Big Brother watching everything you do and you have to behave in a certain way, or Fahrenheit 451, where they're burning all the books, making you watch TV, so everybody's thinking the same way and not thinking really, not being themselves anymore. Or Brave New World, where the government just makes you so comfortable. You have this, they give you drugs and give you a soma holiday, so you're high out of your brain and you just think you're enjoying life, but you're not really living. Those are forced, so you have no choice. And that is the one component of a dystopia that we are not experiencing right now. But if we look at a lot of the data of our country, we see that a lot of things are going poorly. We see that there's a lot of addiction. We see that suicide rates are going up. We see that depression is skyrocketing. We see that poor health is increasing. We see that obesity is on the rise like crazy. We see diabetes and heart disease are all rising. We see, despite all of the new technology that we have, the average lifespan in this nation has not only leveled off, but has begun to contract. So potentially our children will be the first generation in the history of this nation where they can expect to live a shorter life than their parents, than us. Given the level of technological advancement and knowledge that we have, that is an astounding contrast. And so, yes, I think there are some significant problems. And one way to quantify that very easily is to look at all the different types of addictions, alcohol addiction, fentanyl and prescription drug addiction, porn addiction, access, by the way, to all of these things, gambling addiction. We can just pick up our phones. When I was a kid, you had to go to Vegas to gamble, or you had to know a bookie that was illegal in some bar. Now, you just pick up a thing, download DraftKings, and you're gambling on every aspect. You know, I can pull up the Masters right now. It's round two of the Masters, and I can bet on one guy's round. Is he going to par the 11th? So access has been gasoline. So we live in this hyper-addictive culture where our health is getting worse. And so the thing about it is, though, that all of that data is mean data. In other words, all of that data is looking at the group, is looking at the collection, is looking at these large samples. But we are individuals, right? So there are outliers in that data. And we are individuals, so we can be the outlier. We have choices to make. And so in one way, the mean data is meaningless. So it doesn't have meaning for us if we choose. If we go along with this inertia of the current of our culture, that is not a good thing. If we decide to be a rebel, to be subversive, and to behave in our own best interests, despite this wave. So when I mentioned Guy Montag was a fireman in Fahrenheit 451. And the firemen in Fahrenheit 451 were paid to, not to put out fires, they were paid to burn books.
Books.
So they were paid to cause fires. What happens with Guy Montag, he's a fireman, right? He goes around and they find these heretics who are hiding books, Thoreau and Shakespeare and, you know, all the great authors of Chaucer and Hemingway and Bakhov and Dostoevsky. They go find the houses, they arrest the people, and they burn down the house with the secret libraries behind the wall. He has this moment where he's like, wait a minute, what are we doing here? I haven't even ever read one of these books. He has an awakening. He becomes a rebel. He becomes one of those people that he used to be persecuting. And he rebels against the system that is a dystopic system. And what a great character, man. Guy Montag, you know, I just love him. And there was a great movie version, 1966 movie version with just this great, you could find it. In fact, somebody that emailed me, a reader emailed me afterwards, and they said they found the full movie on Vimeo. So if you're watching this today and you're looking for this incredible 1966 version of, and the book is great, by the way, too. Ray Bradbury, obviously one of the great, great books of all time. If you're looking for a copy of this movie, you could find it on Vimeo.
We'll do our best to find it. We'll do our best to include it in the show notes. At the very least, we will include your article in the show notes, Phil. And listeners, Phil, thank you for choosing to be here today. Listeners, thank you for choosing to listen in. And Phil, let's end with this. Tell us, what's the latest? What's going on at Pearl Institute? What's going on at Prime Cuts? How can people reach out to you, work with you, read your stuff, listen to your videos?
Yeah, you know, you could just shoot me an email at pperlman@gmail.com, or you could find me on Twitter at pperlman, or you can go to my website, pearlinst.com, the Pearl Institute. Basically, what I do is I help people, you know, as Thoreau said, suck the marrow out of life. I help people live. I help people get healthy. I help people make decisions in their own best interests. I help people be subversive bastards sometimes and really get themselves healthy, mind, body, and spirit. It's what I dedicated my own life to, changed my whole life, changed my relationships with my family, changed the way I conduct business, got back to who I am. You could find me at Prime Cuts, Substack. You're going to put the link out there. And what I'm doing is I'm just pursuing that. That's all I'm doing. Like, I want to help people. I do have a .org where I am doing some pro bono work with people in my own community who can't afford me. I'm a little bit expensive, which I really love doing that because there's people out there who are struggling. There's people out there who maybe don't have the means to afford me, but they are struggling. They're trying, but maybe they don't know how. Or maybe they are caught somewhere, you know, snagged in a net or by a fish hook somewhere. I really, really enjoy that because these are people that I go out into my neighborhood and I see, and I go out into my community and I see. So I've been doing some of that too. You know, as a matter of fact, you asked me where I'd like to be a year from now. 5 years from now, I'd like that to be more and more. If I'm 80-20 now, pearlinstitute.com and pearlinstitute.org, I'd like in 5 years for that to be 20-80.
That's awesome. We will share all those links in the show notes. And Phil Pearlman, thank you so much for joining us today on the Best Interest Podcast.
Jesse, love you, bro. And I'm just so happy to be here. I'm so proud of you, too.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Best Interest Podcast. If you have a question for Jesse to answer on a future episode, send him an email at jesse@bestinterest.blog. Again, that's jesse@bestinterest.blog. Did you enjoy the show? Subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever you listen. This helps others find the show and invest in knowledge themselves, and we really appreciate it. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Best Interest Podcast. The Best Interest Podcast is a personal podcast meant for education and entertainment. It should not be taken as financial advice and is not prescriptive of your financial situation.